It was a coup de main operation, glider-borne, to capture two bridges in Normandy, to land soon after midnight, the day before the seaborne landings on the 6th of June 1944. For this operation, I was given two extra platoons and 30 Royal Engineers. So that was 150 infantry, 30 Royal Engineers, a force of 180. We landed in six gliders. Each glider contained one platoon of around 25 infantry and five Royal Engineers. Three gliders went for a bridge over the River Orne and three gliders for a bridge over the Caen Canal. The Caen Canal bridge was much more important, more heavily defended. It was a waterway used for commercial purposes up to the port of Caen. And most of the defences of the two bridges were around the canal bridge. And that is one reason why I went in number one glider. I was so thrilled to have this special job, the spearhead of the invasion, as it's often been described, that we wanted to get the job done, we wanted to get it done successfully, and that seemed to overcome all fear.
We were literally staggering under the weight of the stuff we were carrying. I personally carried four fully loaded Bren gun mags, plus two bandoliers of 303 ammunition. I had six Mills 36 grenades, two 77 phosphorus smoke grenades, two Norwegian type egg-shaped stun grenades that just made a bang when you threw them. We carried a 24-hour ration pack, which consisted of cubes of tea, soup, oatmeal, toilet paper and a few sweets, matches, and some fuel for the little Tommy cookers.
Everyone was so smashing, you know, let's have a bash and that. In fact, the glider was overweight. We either had to dump some ammo or dump a man off. And Major Howard decided, right, we'd drop a man off. So he came round and he said, someone will have to drop out. Who's going to volunteer? Nobody volunteered. I did suggest Wally Parr, who was a friend of mine in the platoon, because he was married. He went berserk and said, not me, you know, I'm going. And in the end, because he couldn't get a volunteer, we all went.
And suddenly we became airborne. We could barely see, it was quite dark. There was a few cigarettes going. And it was then that there was obviously a tenseness and nervousness, because there wasn't the usual idle chatter, nobody was singing, and there was almost silence within the glider. But within about 10 minutes, the usual round of conversation started, people began to sing, and the tenseness evaporated, you know, and it became just another glider flight.
The flight at about 6,000 feet over the channel was very, very quiet, so much so that for my first time in a glider, I wasn't sick. It was a sort of company joke that I was going to be sick, and some bright lad at the back of the glider would always shout through as the company commander laid his kit yet, which, of course, caused a lot of mirth amongst the rest of the men. But no, that night, nobody used their little paper bag.
Major Howard was always sick when he went flying. And every time somebody would shout out with a comment, has the Major laid his kit yet? And on D-Day, he wasn't sick. I suppose he was so worked up that the operation was eventually taking place that he forgot to be sick.
We heard the glider pilot shout, casting off. And suddenly the roar of the aeroplane engine receded, and we were in a silent world. It was like being trapped in a floating coffin in mid-space. Immediately the glider cast off, the singing, the talk, the conversation stopped. I think people then began to realise what they were heading for. We were now faced with a situation where there was no going back. We'd reached the point where we could only go forward. We were dropping rapidly, and I believe that the pilot was a bit concerned that the glider was coming in too fast. But there's not a lot he could do about it. David Wood suddenly shouted out, "Brace for impact." We all linked arms, lifted our feet off the floor. David had stood up, and with the aid of two others who held him, he opened the front door of the glider. Somebody did the same at the rear door. And he sat down, and we just waited, and we went in at a steep angle. I felt the jerk of the parachute opening. We hit the ground with an almighty thump, rose into the air again, and then suddenly we came to an abrupt stop.
We came in at about 120 miles an hour, hit the ground and lost the wheels, and we bounced back up into the sky, and we had a parachute in the tail of the glider, which the pilot gave the orders to be released. As soon as the parachute opened, it checked the speed of the glider and took us up again, and then we came down and we knew that we was on the skid, so it was locked arms and feet up off the floor, because that is normally the first part that goes, the floor.
The glider was twisting and turning a bit, and looking over the pilot's shoulder, you could see the bridge, and it was exactly like the model we'd been shown previously. And then it vanished, you know, as the glider sort of veered to make his approach to the landing. The next thing, crash, as it hit the deck, and then sparks flying left, right and centre. And all of a sudden it just came to a halt, and silence again, just a creaking of some sort of timber in the glider. And the undercarriage had gone, of course, and the front of the glider was stove in. Danny Brotheridge, who was our platoon commander, he quickly slid open the door and said, "Gun out," which was me. Out I jumped, stumbled on the grass because of the weight I had, and set the Bren up facing the bridge, and the rest of the lads jumped out. Danny Brotheridge just got in front of me. Then he looked round to make sure that everybody was out and said, "Come on, lads." We were about 30 yards from the bridge, I suppose, and we dashed towards it, and I saw a German on the right-hand side, and let rip at him, and down he went. I still kept firing, going over the bridge, and at the other side there was another German, and he went down.
Colossal crash, and then we were airborne again almost immediately. You come in those gliders at about 90 miles an hour on touchdown. And in seconds, of course, there was another touchdown, but this time it was much louder. It shook the glider tremendously because we're on these skids and the wheels have gone. And then we're airborne again for a fracture of a second or so, and the final crash came. The door had disappeared. It had completely telescoped. I could hear the glider pilots on my right moaning in their cockpit, which seemed to have been smashed, but I was conscious that everybody in the glider was moving. You could hear the click of the safety belts being undone, and I knew that men were getting out of the glider, pushing in front of me to get through the broken door. And I emerged from the glider, broke my way through all the debris, the wood that had smashed all round it, and I suppose that really was the most exhilarating moment of my life, because as I stood there, I could see the tower of the bridge about 50 yards from where I was standing, The nose of the glider was right through the German wire fence, where almost facetiously I'd asked the glider pilot to put the glider. And above all, and this was the tremendous thing, there was no firing at all. In other words, we had complete surprise. We really caught old Jerry with his pants down. I followed the platoon up the track. I saw the smoke bomb explode, the phosphorus bomb. I heard the thud, thud, thud in the pillbox as the grenades exploded, and I knew we'd get no more trouble from there. And the leading platoon ran across the bridge.
In the flurry, I remember a German throwing a stick grenade at me. And I saw the explosion and I felt the explosion. My right wrist was hit. I was extremely lucky because the grenade exploded very close to me and hit various parts of my clothing, but not my body, although there were holes in my flying smock. That was the first German I actually shot. Having thrown his grenade, he tried to scramble over the back of one of the walls adjoining the cafe. And I actually shot him with my Sten gun as he went over.
But then the evening did come, the evening of June the 5th, when we got into our lorries and were transported to the airfield. We collected our chutes and our lorries took us around the perimeter, right around miles away into the country, where our aircraft had been dispersed. And the aircraft that we, the battalion, were going to jump out of was the Stirling, which used to be a bomber, but coughed up by the bomber command for us to use in the airborne role. And we were right out in the countryside, away from the hangars, peaceful June evening, lovely and calm. We just sat and talked for a while amongst ourselves, and then the padre came whipping up in his jeep, and we had a little service, had a little prayer, and he wished us well, and then he dashed off again to another aircraft. And then came the jeep of the RAF crew, roaring up, and they got out and they said, "All right, you chaps, don't you worry. Piece of cake, we'll get you there." You know, it was tremendous sort of a light-hearted, excited sort of atmosphere, spirit. And then the time came when we were ordered to emplane.
I was, in fact, dressed in what was jocularly called Christmas tree order, because one's parachute harness had to be sufficiently tight to stop it being jerked off one's shoulders when the chute opened. Consequently, one could barely walk in a proper upright position. Strapped up thus, I also had a 45 Colt automatic, I had a Sten gun through my harness, and I had a very cartridge pistol. And when, on the run into Normandy, the flak started to come up and the pilot started to jink, I fell flat on my back in the doorway of the Dakota plane, and it took two men to lift me to my feet again. Although we had been briefed and told that we would go into Normandy on a flakless route, this proved to be far from the case. And the Germans were, in fact, on an anti-invasion exercise in the very area in which we landed. As a result of all the evasive action taken by the pilots of the different planes, my own battalion was split up to the extent that some of the officers and men were a mile or two away. The man who said he was not scared when he did a parachute jump was a liar, because every jump one did had its attendant nervous tension. But added to that, of course, we had the strain of going into battle for the first time. however well we had been briefed.
When there was about 5 minutes to go, we all moved up closer. I astride the door, looking down, and I hoped to see some of the task force, the armada, but I didn't see any ship at all, and just the speckly wave tops of the sea below me. Suddenly I saw the parallel lines of the waves coming ashore on a dark yellow beach, and then a cliff, woods, copses and hedgerows of the land below me, only about 800 feet below me. And it was a reasonably moonlight night, so I was able to see the ground quite easily. And then red light on, green light, and I jumped through the hole. The roar of the engine and the whish of the wind around one's body all happened suddenly, and then quietness. And like any exercise in England, I found myself floating down to a field, and quite close, a horse was grazing. I landed without any harm, and I heard other people landing around me.
I can also remember the scene when I looked up after landing to see some of our planes in flames and others with tattered wings striving to make their way to the dropping zone. I went straight into the rendezvous point for the 8th Battalion, where we found we were of a strength roughly 120.
When we left the dropping zone, our rendezvous, we were extremely alarmed because C Company had only 30 men and we were very short in numbers. But the CO said we couldn't stay there much longer, we had to get cracking. But when we reached our defensive position, south of the Lombard de Ronville, to our delight, we found a hell of a lot of chaps there already established and digging in like mad. Such was our briefing in England that every soldier knew exactly where he's going to dig his hole and his arcs of fire. It was so clear on the aerial photographs. And so there was no briefing required. The soldier went straight to his little area and started digging in. And the bulk of the battalion were there already digging in. They had been scattered in their drop beyond the dropping zone, and with all this kit that they had to carry, they weren't going to flog all the way back to the rendezvous of the dropping zone and then flog back again to the defensive locality. So they took a shortcut and got themselves established.
We arrived on time over the coast, and quite suddenly anti-aircraft fire, large and small, opened up on us. And I was waiting to jump, and there was an explosion near the tail of the aircraft, and I was propelled, if you like, not exactly blown, and I was ready to jump, but I went, followed by my batman. I actually saw a tracer coming up, and one or two tracer bullets actually went through my parachute. I realized it was extremely dangerous because a Stirling passed under me, and I wondered whether I was going to hit it. And completely chaotic. Aircraft going in all directions except the right ones, and all levels except the right ones. Anyway, I realized that I was not going to drop on the dropping zone. Odds on chances were that I was going to hit a building which I knew was either a German battalion or company headquarters. I hit it at first floor level. My shoulder was about the level of the windowsill, and then I dropped down to the ground. Somebody threw open the window and looked out, and I was fumbling around for something to throw at him, a grenade or something, but our grenades were not primed. And one of my corporals suddenly appeared from nowhere, and he picked up a brick or a rock or something and hurled it up at this man leaning out of the window, who vanished. We had to make our way away from the house, and we didn't go straight to the dropping zone, because if there were German troops there, we didn't want to lead them straight onto the dropping zone. We met two rather stout German soldiers on bicycles. We stopped, and when we told them we were British troops, they said that they were rather sick and tired of the SS dressing up in British uniforms and doing exercises, and could they please get back to barracks? So we did convince them they were British troops. We took their rifles and threw them into the marshy water and told them to get on their bikes, literally, and get the hell out of it, which they did rather thankfully. I often wondered what happened to them.